Good afternoon, stroke evening, everyone, depending on where on the planet you are. Thank you for joining this last session of the conference today, which is looking at what the sustainable vineyard and winery will look like in 2030. And as we've managed to do all day, we have an excellent panel. I'll get them to introduce themselves in a bit more detail in a moment. But when we had a pre-meeting yesterday, it was suggested by one of our panel that I set out what I thought a vineyard and winery might look like by 2030. And then the panel members who were actually having to do this sort of stuff for real tell us whether that's realistic and what they might need to do to actually get there. So I thought I'd take people up on that and see where we go from there. Vineyard and winery in 2030, obviously you're going to have all energy produced on site. You're not going to need any energy to be brought in from outside. Heading towards carbon neutral, if not already there, and becoming carbon positive. To do that, we'll see things like increased use of trees and shading and of cover crops, minimization of soil tillage, so and other issues to do with vineyard management. We'll see a lot more electric vehicles rather than diesel burning tractors. In terms of the vineyard chemistry, we'll see the use of problematic chemicals minimized as far as is possible and the impact of those managed effectively. And of course, optimized water use. I was chairing a session earlier on water, and as someone rightly observed, if we only look at reduction of the amount of water in wine, then actually we don't produce wine because we need water to actually make wine. So so an optimized use of water and, you know, water capture and all those sorts of things. So that's just my sort of little sort of set out of what I think that might look like by 2030. Maybe 2030 is slightly optimistic, say, you know, 2 or 3 years after that. So let's stick with that. So where we're going to go now is see from our panelists whether they think I've missed out anything meaningful. Whether they think what I've said is realistic or not, and thirdly, how we think we're going to get there. So let's start off with the first question. Have I missed anything? And I'm going to, as my usual technique with these things is, I'm going to start with the people who sort of top left of my screen and work along, because it saves me forgetting anyone, especially at this time of the afternoon. So I'm going to start off with Greg. If you just briefly introduce yourselves, each of you introduce yourself and we'll take it from there. So Greg, over to you.
Sure. Thank you, Peter. My name is Greg Jones. Historically, I've been a wine climatologist in my professional academic career, but I have left academia and moved to Avicella Vineyards and Winery in Oregon and run our operation now, where we have nearly 80 acres of grapes and produce a range of varieties here that fit our climate and our ecosystem. You know, and Peter, I'm thinking overnight about some of this after our conversation yesterday. I think one thing I want to mention is when I first started in academia in the late 80s, early 90s, and I was installing weather stations and soil moisture sensors and piezometers and other things, you know, I recall how crude everything was in terms of our instrumentation, even though we were collecting very good data. I really think the vineyard of the future, accelerating from that time period when I first started to the middle of this coming century, really looks at technology. And we already have come a long way over the past 20, 30, 40 years. But I think in the future, we will be on the fly with information. You'll be able to go into your vineyard and your mobile devices will absorb everything around you because we're monitoring everything around us. And the more that we can capture that kind of information on the fly, I believe will allow us to better understand not only our operation in terms of producing wine, grapes and wine, but also understand how our vineyards and the surrounding landscapes are ecosystems that need to function, and understanding how those functioning frameworks actually work. So I believe technology is already driving some of this. I think technology will continue to advance to some ways that we just, I think we can imagine today, but you know, looking forward to that that time where everything is just in our fingertips and on the fly.
Thanks for that. And of course, if we believe Apple, it's only a short question of time before our IT is more intelligent than us, which frankly, by the back end of Wednesday afternoon, in my own case, I'm not terribly surprised at. But there we go. Chris, moving to you next.
Yeah, I'm a wine journalist, the editor of Canopy, which is a newsletter that goes to wine producers. And I make a small collection of ultra niche wines in Central and Eastern Europe. And I agree, technology would have a huge part to play in the future. I mean, I can see little robots running up and down between the aisles, between the rows of vines, collecting data that we can use, and maybe doing jobs in the vines at the same time. I think the other thing that you missed out that I'm quite keen on is using peewee grapes, you know, the fungus resistant varieties. I think they will have a role to play in the future. Maybe some of the ancestral varieties as well can make a comeback and add to the biodiversity in vineyards.
Thanks very much for that. Laura, over to you.
Yes, hi, thank you. So like Greg, I had another career before coming to wine. I'm currently the managing director of Catena Zapata, my family winery, and a few other projects. And I founded the Catena Institute of Wine in 1995 with the vision of using science to preserve nature and culture. And both are important, nature and culture. And given all this talk about technology, which I do agree that there will be more technology in the future, there already is a lot more now than when I started working with my father 25 years ago. I actually, feel that culture, the culture of wine, the people who have grown up in the vineyards in Argentina, we have so many staff members who are fifth generation winemakers, fourth generation. We have, husband, wife, the kids working in our team. I think there's this lifestyle related to wine that we could easily lose if we let the machines take over that. So I'm actually a proponent for, really studying what are things that can be replaced by machines, but what are things that people enjoy doing, not pruning. Pruning should probably be replaced because it's so bad on your body. So there's a lot of things that are hard on your body, but, also as a medical doctor, I think that some things should be done by machines, but I think there's a lot of things that provide joy for people. And what else are we going to do with our time if we're just on our phone, telling, the water to go here or there? So I'm a proponent for also figuring out how to preserve the culture around wine and people who live from wine and live in these beautiful locations that we all live in. In terms of the winery of the future and the vineyard of the future, I think that essential will be collaboration with your colleagues, your local colleagues, as well as people internationally. And I have a couple of examples of things we've done at the Institute, which without the collaboration from outside of Argentina and without collaboration from the local university and research center would have been impossible. And I think, when many of us perhaps rebelled against the flying winemaker concept, where there were these people coming from other parts of the world and telling you what to do, which often didn't really work with your own climate. And that's partly why I founded the Catena Institute, because I wanted to study, things like, do you remove the leaves to let the sun come in? Well, in Mendoza, if you do that at the very high altitude, your grapes burn. So that's not the right thing to do. There's places where they don't irrigate. We need to irrigate because we're a high altitude desert. So what I think the winery of the future will have is research oriented people. And I think that is essential. And our Catena Institute, which has a team of about 8 people, which is, a rather large team for a winery, is also the training grounds for all our staff. Often go through the Institute, they learn how to do research, and then they have a research mind when they're, doing their work every day. And I think that with climate change, every person is going to have to do a little research trial, So let's say you have this parcel that doesn't look so good. What's the problem? Is it, a vineyard virus? Is it wood disease? Is it something to do with the water? And I think that in order to train people in research thinking, you will need collaboration, collaboration with local people, collaboration with people from other parts of the world. So Greg Jones is a great example of one of our collaborators. We wanted to explain to the world that Malbec had a different flavor, at different altitudes and different soils, just like Pinot Noir does, because people thought that somehow Malbec was all the same. And one of our researchers, Roy Urbieta, a very talented young man who actually grew up in a tiny little village and now is finishing his PhD, started this incredible project to develop the chemical fingerprint of Malbec and figure out, you know, do we have terroir for Malbec? Can we identify the components of a Malbec at different altitudes? And, you know, we thought, who is the climate expert in the world that can help us analyze the climate data? And we found Greg, who actually collaborated with our team and then was part co-author of this incredible study that came out in Scientific Reports. So in conclusion, I think the wine of the future will need to be research-minded. We'll have to think about how to preserve our vineyard culture and not replace everything with machines. And we'll have to collaborate both locally and internationally.
Okay, Laura, thanks very much for that. And it's always nice when one panel member starts congratulating another. I think that sort of demonstrates that we've managed to get the right people on the panel. Jason, over to you.
Yes, I'm Jason Haas, second generation proprietor at Tablas Creek Vineyard in Paso Robles, California. We've been here for about 34 years, but we're co-founded by the Perrin family from Chateau de Beaucastel in Chateau Neuf-du-Pape. So we have five generations of Perrins looking over our shoulder with everything that we're doing. And
no pressure then.
We see them regularly. We actually just had a visit from them last week, and we spent a lot of time talking about kind of the adaptations that they're making in the Rhone and about what we feel like we need to make here in California. And if there was a theme, it was essentially bringing the allocation of resources up to date with a future that's likely different from what the even fairly recent decades have been. Thinking in California, for example, there's been a push between like 25 years ago and just a few years ago to bring greater vine density, to work with lower vigor rootstocks, to make what in essence is a decision that would be right for a resource-rich present, mm-hmm. but which for a future where we know that we are likely to be facing more heat, greater droughts, maybe doesn't make sense. So I think planting based on availability of resources is something that I think you'll see change with deeper rooting, higher vigor rootstocks, less vine density, a greater move back towards dry farming in places that permit it, or planting in ways that minimize the amount of irrigation you need to do in places where you do need to irrigate. And also the choices of grapes, a little bit like what Chris was saying, choosing grapes that are adapted to the climate that you're in, as we gather more information in these relatively new regions that we're in, so that we're not planting something which is going to require a huge input in outside resources in order to do well. So in terms of the vineyard, I see those changes coming. In terms of the farming side of it, I think the kind of flowering of ideas around regenerative farming, the idea that you can be putting more carbon into your soil than you are allowing it to release, the idea that you can have positive impacts on your ecosystem, your environment, your neighbors, your neighborhood, your people. I feel like that is going to go from something which is an interesting discussion on the fringe to something which is going to be kind of a central part of conversations for farming. And then in the winery, efforts towards, as Peter said at the beginning, towards minimizing the amount of power you need to bring from outside, generating it on site. Things like capture of CO2 from fermentation offers, I think, a huge amount of potential. And then in packaging, moving towards lighter weight packaging, more reusable packaging, more circular economies on the things that we are using, will allow us to kind of address the challenges of resource scarcity and climate change from multiple angles.
Okay, thanks very much indeed for that. I want to come back to Regen Ag in a minute, because I think that's a subject that gets talked about quite a lot, and it's not always clear quite what it means in practice. So we'll come back to that one. Julian, you asked me to come to you last because you want to sort of open up to some extent the external pressures that others have alluded to, which are making themselves felt.
Exactly. So I'm Julian Gervreau. I was formerly the vice president of sustainability for Jackson Family Wines. And I occupied that role for about the last 10 or so years. And in that time, I was involved intimately in the development and the founding of International Wineries for Climate Action. I'm still on the board today. And so that's the hat that I'm wearing for this presentation. The other hat that I wear is as a sustainability and ESG consultant. So the last couple of years, I've taken a broader lens outside of the wine industry, really looking at some global sustainability and ESG trends. And I think what I would underscore, in response to all these fantastic examples that everybody's given, and I agree with all of them, is the importance of measurement and reporting moving forward. So all of the technology advancement that we're seeing really lends itself to the progression, I think, of more robust reporting, particularly on the sustainability front. And as we move into the future, I think those reporting demands are going to increase, and they're going to be driven primarily by, I think, the investment community, but other key stakeholders like key customers and lenders and whatnot, who are really looking at things like risk across their organizational footprints. So, on the emissions front, and this was discussed, but it's the importance, and this is what IWCA does, obviously, is the importance of measuring an organization's carbon footprint across scopes 1 through 3, and then setting and aligning with a robust emissions reduction target in alignment with what we need in order to secure a livable future. So looking forward to 2030, we're forecasting basically what the scientific consensus is that we need to cut global emissions roughly in half. So that's a lot to bite off and a lot to accomplish in the next 6 and a half years. I think we're going to see more pressure on that, and we're already starting to see it, I think, with some of the questions that are coming in from key retailers and whatnot. And then more broadly, on the ESG front, and ESG is an acronym for environmental, social, and governance. And that's really kind of the context for how the investment community measures risk, external risk factors to organizations. And we're seeing a harmonization of global ESG frameworks under the auspices of a group called the International Sustainability Standards Board, or ISSB. And I think that there is a great opportunity for impact-driven wineries and wine companies and the wine sector in general to take all the leadership that we've done over the last few decades and really make sure that what we are reporting out on and the metrics that we're reporting out on are really aligned and in concert with these global ESG frameworks, so that we can continue to maintain that leadership role within the global financial community.
Okay, thanks for that. Because I think it's important with all these things to understand where the different pressures are coming from. I mean, it's been interesting talking to a lot of people over the last year who are growing wine or growing grapes to make wine. How for a lot of them the challenges are very real. They are facing, as each of you has said, problems or challenges in relation to, you mentioned it, Laura. You take too much foliage off a vine, the grapes frazzle. But in the same time, in other places, they're being flooded. We were speaking to a grower last year in Italy who'd lost 40% of their vines because of a hailstorm. So it's interesting to also see this sort of wider sort of political, I suppose, structures that are coming into place. I'd just say to everyone in the audience, for those of you who have questions, either please raise your hand or put a comment in the chat box, because it'd be great to hear from everyone on the ground. But until that happens, there's a few points I want to sort of pick up with the panel. I'll pick up on the point I've already mentioned first, this question of regen ag. I mean, it's a subject I deal with quite a lot of different agricultural supply chains, and it's a terminology that gets used increasingly and has been for the last, year, 2 years. But I'm not unconvinced that for quite a lot of people, there's a terminology which perhaps lacks as much content as it might eventually need. So it would be useful to perhaps look at what some of the elements might be of regen ag, I mean, actual practical steps that can be taken for regen ag in grape grain. And in no particular order, I'm going to come to Laura first.
Yeah, so, you know, the big question that I have is, how do you apply what they're doing in the United States, what they're doing in Europe, to a place like Argentina? And so what we have done in terms of regenerative agriculture is start all kinds of research trials. We have one in terms of biochar. We have one with mycorrhiza, you know, seeing how the plants are affected by that. We are looking at llamas, who are actually seem to be better than sheep at eating the grass and fertilizing, and they're local. We're doing a research on cover crops. And the interesting thing is that you can bring cover crops from outside, but if you find a native cover crop, they're usually better adapted. But the one native cover crop, we're having this big problem right now that we're having a hard time reproducing it in volume. And that's where actually our approach is, that we're talking to experts and we're talking to people in Germany about cover crops. You know, our Cadena Institute leader, Fernando Usema, is kind of amazing at keeping his contacts all over the world. And we're actually trying to get some suggestions about how to grow these native cover crops that have so much promise, but right now we're not quite sure how to mass multiply them. So, you know, the short answer to your question is, I think there's a lot of tools, but I still feel very alone in Argentina, in that I feel like we have fewer tools. For example, in California, you know, if you want to calculate your carbon sequestration in your soil, you log into this website and you plug in, you know, your vineyard, all kinds of information, and it spits out some information. We tried to figure out to have somebody help us with this. And, you know, they said, you know, we'll do it for this one vineyard, and it'll be $30,000. You know, so I think that actually more international collaboration about regenerative farming and the measurement, I think what Julien said, you know, a lot of people are asking us to measure, and it's not cheap to measure. If Sustainable Wine Roundtable could help with this, I would be very grateful as well.
I think, without wanting to pour too much pressure on us, I think that is something that down the line I think would be helpful, because, as you say, there's quite a lot of activity. There's probably often more activity going on in the measuring of what happens rather than in the what happens, which I'm not sure is always very useful. Okay, so let's move north. Greg, what's your view on, you know, Laura's come up with some very interesting ideas. I love the llamas, because you can also make jumpers out of their wool, so even better. Greg, what would your thoughts be?
Well, I think I said it a little bit earlier, but the idea that being aware of your ecosystem, I think, is really important. You know, the picture behind me is my family's vineyard, but I think the things that I learn the most about to help me manage the vineyard, both today and as I look to the future, is going into the woods, going into the creek areas, looking at the landscapes, looking at the plants, looking at the organisms that exist within those ecosystems and how they function around me, so that I can better understand how to help them function within the vineyard as well. And so I think it's just really being aware of your ecosystem and being very deliberate relative to how it functions.
I'd actually quite like to pick up on that a bit further, because I mean, one of the things, I mean, we found it in terms of putting this this conference together, you sort of necessarily sometimes, when one's talking about sustainability, have to sort of divide out issue by issue. Whereas almost definitionally, the whole concept of an ecosystem is that actually at certain points, all these things interlock, and it's understanding literally the sort of interconnectivity of stuff. Do you think, and Greg, I'll keep with you on this one, and I'll come to Jason. You can think about it, because then you can then answer both questions. Do you think we're getting, Greg, do you think we're getting better at that, kind of seeing the whole thing as different moving parts? You change what happens to one, and that has a knock-on effect to something else, and how to balance those over time. Do you think we're getting better at that, or if not, what do we need to do better?
Well, I think if you go from maybe where we were in conventional agriculture, large-scale agriculture, the idea of being aware of your ecosystem is pretty minimal, really. And so as we've moved into more systems that look at sustainability initiatives, organic production, biodynamic production, I think all of those are all about being more aware, putting your boots on the ground and being able to really see the functioning system that you're working with. I just think people just need to be more engaged with that. And I think we've come a long way, but we have a long way to go as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Jason, your turn.
Yeah, I think I'll answer your second question first. I feel like in the world of wine, I feel like biodynamics is sort of the gold standard for thinking about all of this as an interconnected system. It is tied up with some stuff that I'm not convinced is helpful in the sort of more cycles of the moon mysticism pieces that I think restrict its ability to get adopted more broadly, because for too many people, it seems too out there. But in terms of its farming prescriptions and farming recommendations, like that really is the essence of an interconnected system. Mm. And with that as sort of the starting point, I think that's a great way of thinking about a unified definition for what regenerative farming could be. I feel like if I had to encapsulate it, it would be basically farming in a way so that your farming choices have positive impacts, not just on your soil, but on your neighbors, on your communities, and on the broader environment. So there's a lot of overlap in practical terms with what you might find in something like biodynamics, but I think of it as being mostly focused on things like making sure you have cover crops growing and you're avoiding bare earth so that you are photosynthesizing all the time, reducing your tillage so that you are capturing that carbon and the root system growth instead of re-releasing it back into the atmosphere, increasing your biodiversity in your vineyard so you're avoiding the monoculture and the brittleness that monocultures can bring. And then consciously thinking about your farm's ability to sequester carbon, which has the additional benefit usually of allowing your soils to hold more moisture and reducing the amount of water that you need to use. So we're a part of the Regenerative Organic Certified Program, which is just really getting rolled out even in the United States. And I know they have plans to roll out more globally going forwards, but that includes all those farming pieces, but also requirements for how you treat your workers, requirements for animal welfare if you have a working flock or herd on your property, and requirements of things that might be more like what you would see in a B Corp, where you're required to do sort of social good as well as farming good. So they're trying to codify what this means from a certification standpoint. But in terms of the definition of the farming more broadly, it's that your farming has positive outcomes beyond just what you're doing for your soil.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Chris, you say you grow in Central Europe. So again, yet another different, I'm not sure they have llamas there.
They have, yeah, llamas, alpacas, sheep. Small sheep are quite common in parts of Slovenia. I think it's sort of like a return to some of the old ways. But with the regenerative style, you're sort of progressing it a bit. I think there's a lot of goodwill when people take up sustainability and organic farming and biodynamic farming. But I think regenerative farming just takes it that step. And, you know, some of the less environmentally friendly practices in organic farming are taken out. And maybe people do an organic farming, but they don't realise, you know, some of the practices are not as sustainable as perhaps they would wish. And I think just moving beyond biodynamics, beyond organic to regenerative, just is better for, as Jason said, the neighbors and the whole system.
Hmm. Yeah, it must be. We, at this point, I can flag up we're doing some work with a number of growers on specifically looking at inputs, which obviously does end up shading into sort of regen processes. And it is a question of, you know, yes, as you say, you've got organic practice, you've got biodynamic practice, both of which have got sort of, as it were, brands associated with them or have become brands. But it's, are there other ways forward which may be appropriate, which don't necessarily fall into those categories? I think it's interesting to explore that. Julian, I want to come to you with a slightly different question, which is, given all of this, given that what everyone's describing on the growing side is some fairly significant shifts in the way in which things happen. Now, obviously, that's going to have implications, or may have implications, in terms of intensity of production, productivity rates. There's at some stage going to be costs involved with doing some of this if there's other equipment that's needed. You've talked about the wider sort of envelope, particularly looking at ESG. To what extent do you think there's an appreciation in the non-wine world, the muggle world, as it were, that this is, there's a shift going, that what they want is going to require some quite significant shifts, and that means that perhaps the way in which balance sheets and profit and loss accounts look over time might look different?
That's a very loaded question. I'll do my best to answer it. I did want to touch on the regenerative.
Touch away.
Farming discussion briefly, just to underscore, I think what everybody has said is really the need to define what you mean by regenerative agriculture. And Jason just provided some really, really good specific examples. But you also need to measure it. And I think that, you know, ROC, the Regenerative Organic Certification, is a really good leading certification that is doing exactly that. But as was mentioned, it's predicated on a farm first being certified organic. And, you know, that's not necessarily feasible for every vineyard. So if you are going to be talking about regenerative agriculture, you need to be very careful and very conscientious about how you define it, how you measure the results, and also just recognizing kind of that it is context-based. Okay, so as it relates to where things are going, I mean, I think what I am seeing is that there is just an increasing level of demand for disclosure information that is primarily being led by the global investment community. What's really interesting for anybody who's been following the ESG movement in the United States in particular, it's become incredibly politicized. So there's an entire kind of anti-ESG woke backlash against what some people on the political spectrum see as government overreach. And I think that completely misses the point that ESG is really being driven by a desire for standard reporting around non-financial sustainability metrics that help the investment community identify and understand and scope risk for their various investment portfolios. And that all sounds really kind of scary and financial. And when we talk to, you know, the companies that we work with, our focus, particularly for small to medium-sized businesses, is really just basically understanding what these ESG metrics are, the types of questions, the types of key performance indicators or KPIs that these frameworks are adopting and asking for, and then really focusing on leveraging your own internal impact business model. And the wine industry, I think we are world renowned for embedding impact into our business models broadly across the globe. But defining and identifying and aligning your impact business model with the general understanding of these ESG frameworks so that you are prepared for the disclosure requests that are coming. And you can respond and you can measure the health of your business as it relates to some of these sustainability KPIs that, you know, really also advance just general business resiliency, if that answers the question.
Yeah, I think it answers it insofar as we can without getting into some quite complicated and come next November, quite sensitive politics.
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is take the politics out of it and focus on how these help you identify risk and how they can be used to kind of embed impact into your business in a way that you know the standards are requiring.
How naive of you letting fact and analysis get in the way of political thought?
I'm American. What can I say?
Greg, you want to come in?
Well, I want to bring up the economics of some of this. We've talked a little bit about alternative energies, and solar is kind of the big one. We've talked about biochar being a very important component of helping your soils manage water and nutrition better. My issue with this whole thing is the economics of it don't work. Solar power and biochar should be available to everybody, small businesses, large businesses, not just the ones with money. We need to be able to break this down and get the greed out of the system so that everybody has access to these kind of tools. Only then will we have enough critical mass that we can move forward as an industry. If we just have individuals with money that can do these kind of things, we're not going to get anywhere. Mm-hmm. And so that's my big issue with the overall kind of energy, kind of economic component.
I think that is a point well made. I mean, one of the things we've seen in quite a lot of the work that we're doing is that some of this stuff, by which I mean everything to do with sustainability, even filling in the questionnaires for the ESG guys, is fine if you're a large winery with a management team that allows you to have people who've got sustainability on their job description. You know, if you're, you know, 2.5 people running a vineyard, however keen you might be on doing it, it's harder. And as you say, that some of this stuff does require, or potentially does require, investment that may not be feasible. So I think one thing that we need to look at is how you can get big, small collaboration. We've done a couple of events recently with the Prosecco DOC in Italy, and they're approaching this whole thing as an entire DOC. So the big guys will help the small guys. So they all go forward together. Which, given that we've got 3 minutes left, I just want each of you quickly to pick up on that agenda. You've all talked about the need for collaboration, but you've also all talked about the fact that there's a need for all of this stuff to be very sensitive to local circumstances, local situations. Laura, you were talking about, I know I joked about llamas, but absolutely makes sense. Why not use a local breed? Ditto cover crops. How, in terms of collaboration, you've each got about 30 seconds on how can we get collaboration going, which is sharing knowledge, but at the same time recognizes that there's a need for local specificity? I'm going to start at the other end of the screen this time. So, Chris, that means it's you to start.
Another thing, just more talks like this, more networking events, just getting together. There's a lot of good publications using those, and hopefully the wine industry can lead agriculture and set a really good example for the whole of the food and agriculture industry.
Okay. Julian, you next.
I think it's more discussion, more collaboration. I mean, I represent International Wineries for Climate Action, and our whole focus is on standardization around how we measure carbon, the carbon cycle across the global wine industry. And, you know, we have a number of free resources, including a carbon calculator that anybody can use. And it is not predicated on being a member of our organization. I think that it's extending and defining what we mean by all of these things, such as regenerative agriculture, and also aligning with global standards so that we're all singing from the same playbook, as it were.
Jason, you're nodding most vigorously.
Well, I agree very much with what Julian just said. I think a lot of it is going to be supporting the organizations that are already active in this space. I do think that certifications really matter because it creates a community around a set of standards and make sure that you're speaking the same language when you're talking about them. And that can be both groups like International Wineries for Climate Action or Regenerative Organic Alliance, or it can be regional associations who I think have a pretty important role to play in kind of translating a lot of these sustainability and regenerative goals to a broader membership that may not be thinking about them because that's something that they're inherently interested in.
Okay, great. Greg.
Well, I'm going to turn to my academic side. And basically, I really feel that my academic colleagues, myself, we all need to be doing the research that the industry needs, not the research that's fundable. And we also need to be able to get that research out in ways which the industry can ingest it. And I don't mean CEOs of companies, I mean vineyard managers and winemakers that can take good research that is being done specifically to solve problems and apply it quickly. And right now we don't have that in place.
Okay. Laura, I'll leave the last word to you.
Yeah. So I agree with the concept that you have to measure, you have to certify. And we have this incredible program in Argentina that has got us all together thinking of how to solve problems. The second thing is the culture around sustainability, you have to hammer it in. And we have a program where everybody at our winery plants trees. Our customers that come, nobody can leave Argentina without planting a tree. And it's a small act, but it embeds a certain culture in what you do. And you know what Greg said about going to the creeks, like you have to fall in love with the nature. If everybody falls in love with these places, we can preserve them. And the last thing I want to say to all of you from first world countries is that, for example, a person in Argentina has 25% of the carbon emissions as a person in the US, an average person. And going back to the Paris Agreement concept, I think that first world countries do have an obligation to support some of us in developing countries. And so, Julian, I'm going to take you up on that carbon calculation. Maybe we can have a call and you can show us how to use it, because we've tried to use it and it was not that simple. Because you guys, we're here, we want to get your help, but we want you to be aware that we have fewer carbon emissions because we're poorer. And I think that's a concept that everybody needs to get in their head.
That coming back to things like the Paris Accord, I think, are always valuable, although sometimes trying to persuade first world governments of the fact they should actually deliver on what they've promised is sometimes a little harder. But that's not to say that background doesn't provide leverage to make it happen. Thank you all very much indeed. It's been a great conversation. I really enjoyed our chat yesterday as well. And I think to really second what both Jason and Greg were saying is we need more of these conversations. We need to keep this sort of dialogue going, because, you know, the amount of stuff that comes out that one didn't know was there, because it comes out in discussion. It's not necessarily readily available in a public domain. And there are ideas that then can be shared. Obviously, sharing is what we try and do at SWR, to try and find ways forward, to try and find ways in which on different topics, and I've just seen Tom's put in the chat some of the stuff that we're up to try and share expertise, share knowledge on different topics. For today, thank you everyone for coming along to the conference today, but particularly thank you to the speakers here. To Julian, to Chris, to Greg, to Laura, and to Jason. Thank you so much for your time, so much for your thoughts, and enjoy the rest of your days.